next month, if we think about in winter here, how great it is not to have all the snow and the wind and all that. But really, if you think about it, there's a lot of people who depend on that snow and the cold, plowing it, selling boots and snow blowers for their living. So I've come to conclusion, I don't like winter, but I realize a lot of people use it as income and support their families. So I've come around on it to kind of come to an understanding. I don't like you still, but you support a lot of people. Last weekend, family and I were watching a movie, and some of you probably know it pretty well, Home Alone. It's a story, and I guess in case you don't know about it, I'll kind of give you the recap of it or the short story. It's a story about an 8-year-old kid named Kevin. And Kevin's kind of a, what you'd call him, punk little kid, and he's smart-alecky, back-talks his parents, very rude. And his family doesn't show him much respect. He's the youngest sibling. They don't talk to him very nice, don't treat him very nice. Well, on the night before the family leaving for France, the cousins were over, an aunt and uncle were over to the house. And they're all eating pizza, getting ready for the evening. And Kevin decides to push his older brother, Buzz, who's a typical older brother, pounds him, talks to him badly, you know, treats him really bad. Pushes him into an open container of Pepsi, spill over passports, everyone gets their hands up in the air, and everyone stops and just looks at Kevin, and mean Uncle Frank says, "Look what you did, you little jerk." Well, at this point, his mom grabs a hold of his arm, marches him upstairs. He has to stay in the third floor, up in kind of this attic space for the night, because his aunts and uncles and probably his cousins are going to use his room. And he has to stay up there all by himself. Somewhere during the night before they're leaving to go to the airport, storm blows in, knocks a limb down on power lines, which isn't the power company's fault, by the way. Knocks a limb onto it, and alarm clocks don't have to go off. And, you know, nowadays we all use our cell phones. At least I use a cell phone to get up in the morning. But, you know, everybody had regular alarm clocks that are plugged into the wall. Well, they didn't wake them up in the morning, and they were woke up by a shuttle company pounding on the door to take them to the airport. Well, they wake up frantically, run around, and in haste they leave the house. And they miscount the kids, because a neighbor boy came over and was hanging out. So they miscount them, and they forget about waking Kevin up on the third floor. So Kevin's at his house all by himself. Somewhere over the Atlantic Ocean, as they're flying to France, the mother realizes, "We forgot Kevin," then frantically tries to get back to the United States, back to Chicago where they live. Well, during this time, it's about relatively, I think, 3 days, Kevin has to be the man of the house. He has to grow up. Can't be the little brother anymore. And he wished it. He wished this on himself. He wished his family would disappear. He didn't like him anymore. And he also has to fend off 2 second-rate cat burglars from trying to steal everything in the house, which he does pretty good, which is really a comedic part of it if you haven't watched the movie. But throughout this time, Kevin begins to miss his family, and even mean Uncle Frank. So he prays to God, wishes they'd come back, and says, "Even Uncle Frank can come back. That's okay." And the mother in the process and the family begins to miss Kevin. Well, finally they get reunited. It's a happy scene. Older siblings have respect for Kevin because he actually didn't burn the house down. He looked clean. The house was clean. Everything was in order. So now they have respect for Kevin. They appreciate him. He appreciates them because he didn't have him anymore. Isn't that kind of the point of it, though? It's about appreciation. It wasn't really about comedy. The point of the movie was about everybody appreciating each other and being grateful for themselves. Unfortunately, we find ourselves too often in that case, don't we? We miss or realize how much we miss something, or we become grateful for what we did have or don't have when it's not there anymore. And that's quite often where, you know, even myself being, you know, we can be that way, I can be that way, and then all of a sudden you don't have it anymore and you realize, wow, that was really not that bad, was it? It wasn't perfect, but it wasn't that bad. And that's the title of, brings me to the title of my sermon today. Do you have an attitude of gratitude? An attitude of gratitude. So I think it kind of is easy to remember, and I kind of like the sound of it. But it makes the point. It's not just Gratitude isn't something you say. Being thankful isn't something you just say when you hold the door from somebody and or they walk through and they say thank you to you. Are they really grateful? I don't know. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. But being grateful is an attitude. Dale Carnegie dedicated a whole chapter of his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, on showing appreciation. This was so important to him in how you win friends and influence others that he thought that it would dedicate a whole chapter to it. And he used many examples of how other people would show appreciation, would talk and be grateful to others without showing flattery, by the way. It was very important to him that there's a difference between being shown appreciation and flattering someone with cheap talk. He wrote this: I once succumbed to the fad of fasting and went for 6 days and nights without eating. It was difficult. It wasn't difficult. I was less hungry at the end of the sixth day than I was at the end of the second. Yet I know, as you know, people who think they had committed a crime if they let their families or employees go with 6 days without food. But they will let them go for 6 days, 6 weeks, and sometimes 60 years without giving them the hearty appreciation that they crave as much as they crave food. I think we all can appreciate that, don't we? We all know gratitude, being told thank you, showing appreciation is something we all like to get from our spouses, our kids, co-workers, friends, family members. We all like that. And it's very difficult. I found myself, I really liked getting that. But I find it hard giving it. And so I've always appreciated and kind of admired people who could just slip it in. They just knew how to do it, you know. They could slip in thank you and certain aspects of appreciation. You're just like, wow, that was great. You know, that was good how they did that. And it seemed so natural and easy for them. And so that's something I've always tried to work on, is how I show appreciation and praise and being grateful for what I have. Because some people are really good at it, and other people have to work at it. And this is something I have to work at, which is part of the reason why I prepared this and just thinking about it more. One man that was never shy about showing appreciation, giving praise, being grateful for what he did have, and not thinking about what he didn't, was King David. King David lived to, you know, if you look at it from one aspect, from the aspect of the glass half empty, you would say, boy, he lived a rough life. He was, from the time he was appointed king, God put him inside King Saul's palace. It was kind of a tutoring session, on the job learning for him to view while kingdom worked, the job of a king, how the comings and goings. Probably would have able to overhear many different conversations as he sat inside the palace. Eventually, as things went on, King Saul gave him more and more responsibility. And he'd go out and eventually would lead armies. Was very successful at it. Was very successful at everything he did. And King Saul saw and felt the hand of God being pulled off of him and being put onto David. And it made him very jealous. Throughout that jealousy, King Saul eventually tried to have him killed. To the point where at one time David fled, and then he asked David to come back, or something to that basic relative place, and David did come back. When David came back, King Saul tried to kill him again, tried to basically pin him to the wall with a spear. David was quick, agile at that point. He was able to get out of the way, and then he fled, which started basically 8 years of David fleeing. At that point, David was fleed for 8 years. Could you imagine fleeing for your life from 8 years from the king of a country? I don't think anybody can really appreciate really how difficult that must have been for David. But in that process, he gained the confidence of 600 men. 600 men. And he fled from cave to cave, out in the wilderness, town to town. And eventually, he had two opportunities to kill King Saul, but he didn't. He passed on it. But David had a different attitude towards this, didn't he? After the whole thing was done, he mourned King Saul's death. He wasn't grateful for it. He didn't dance over it. He mourned it. Mourned the death of King Saul and his friend Jonathan. David also succumbed to sin and adultery. As a result of that, he lost his oldest son from that affair with Bathsheba. So for about 7 to 10 days after the baby was dead, baby was alive but sick, and God finally took that baby's life because he realized that baby could not exist properly in this world as a result of adultery, especially from the king. So eventually Solomon was born, but the first child died due to the sin of adultery. David suffered the betrayal of two different sons. I don't think anyone could imagine how that would feel, having two different sons basically betray you, betray your confidence, and eventually try to take over your kingdom. Both didn't end well for them. But that wasn't David's attitude of, God, why did you put me in this situation? Why did you put me here? You know, my life as a shepherd wasn't that bad. All I had to do was fend off some sheep or fend off some wolves and bears from my sheep. That's all I had to do. Now I have to run from a king. I have all these things going on. I have more problems than I ever had. That wasn't his attitude, was it? His attitude was one of praise. Now, a lot of times he asks for support, mental support, and help from God. A lot of times he would lament that he was surrounded by military armies. But he never complained and asked God, you know, why me? Why me? He was happy about at least that he had God in his life. He had his law in his life. Turn to 1 Chronicles 16. At this point, a tabernacle is put together for the Ark of the Covenant. And it kind of had a dedication ceremony at this point of songs and singing, praising God for the ability to have that there. And starting in verse 7, 16th chapter, 1 Chronicles, verse 7. On that day, David first delivered this psalm into the hand of Asaph and his brethren to thank the Lord. O give thanks to the Lord. Call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the people. Sing to him. Sing psalms to him. Talk of all his wondrous works. Glory in his holy name. Let the hearts of those rejoice who seek the Lord. Seek the Lord in his strength. Seek his face evermore. Remember his marvelous works which he has done, his wonders and his judgments of his mouth. O seed of Israel, his servant, you children of Jacob, his chosen ones. He is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. Remember his covenant forever, the word which he commanded for 1,000 generations, the covenant which he made with Abraham and his oath to Isaac, and confirmed it to Jacob for a statute, to Israel for an everlasting covenant, saying to you, I will give the land of Canaan as an allotment of your inheritance. When you were a few in numbers, indeed very few and strangers in it, when they went from one nation to another and went from one kingdom to another people, he permitted no man to do them wrong, yes, he rebuked the kings for their sakes, saying, do not touch my anointed ones, and do my prophets no harm. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Proclaim the good news of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his wonders among all the peoples. For the Lord is great and greatly to be praised. He is also to be feared above all gods, for all the gods of peoples are idols. But the Lord made the heavens. Honor and majesty are before him. Strength and gladness are in his place. Give to the Lord, O families of the peoples. Give to the Lord glory and strength. Give to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come before him. O worship the Lord in his beauty of holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. The world also is firmly established. It shall not be moved. Let the heavens rejoice, and let the earth be glad. And let them say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Let the sea roar in all its fullness. Let the field rejoice, and all that is in it. Then the trees of the wood shall rejoice before the Lord, for he is coming to the judgment of earth. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endures forever. And say, save us, O God, for our salvation. Gather us together and deliver us from the Gentiles to give thanks to your holy name, to triumph in your praise. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel from everlasting to everlasting. And the people said, amen, and praise the Lord. Does that sound like a man who had an attitude of, woe is me, or how bad is it? Oh, man. That was a man who was awful excited about having the God he had and the life he had been put into. That's an attitude of someone who was grateful, who didn't see the world half full, or half empty, excuse me, saw it half full. Let's look at some definitions of thankful and the word grateful. In Merriam-Webster, the first one is, the first definition, is conscious of benefit received. Number two, expressive of thanks. Or three, well pleased and glad. Grateful. The first one is 1A here. Appreciative of benefits received. Expressing gratitude. Affording pleasure or contentment. Pleasing. Pleasing by reason of comfort supplied or discomfort alleviated. I think there's something interesting there if you look at it. The first definitions in both of these, which is generally the most common one or the best one they felt, is conscious of benefit received for thankful and appreciative of benefits received, and that's for grateful. So in both cases, you've received something and you need to be conscious of it or appreciative of it. And that's the truth, isn't it? I mean, if we don't know we've received a benefit, we don't really realize we have a benefit, we're not going to be thankful for it, right? So that's what basically the definition is. And I think that's very important. So let's take a look at that. What are we not conscious of or appreciative of that we should be? Let's take a look at it here. What about our own congregations? Our church, our local congregations, the ecclesia that we belong to here. Do we really appreciate the fact that we have a place to come every Sabbath and worship? People of like mind. That we have a people to give a message every week. We can sing songs. A lot of times I think we're conscious of not having a piano player today, and more appreciative we are when we do have one. I have a friend who calls me, and I'll call him occasionally, out in New Mexico. He belongs to the United Church of God out there. It's a small congregation. I think it's him and maybe a handful of older ladies, maybe two or three older ladies. You think if he was here today, how much more appreciative he would be than maybe we are of having all the people here, of having a person to speak to you. He has to hook up by Skype to hear a sermon. And when he sings, he's singing over to whatever, you know, whatever they're playing music in that congregation in Texas, and music's playing over the computer. So he has to listen and sing with those ladies. He doesn't have a piano player, doesn't have a PA system, doesn't have a live speaker, doesn't have a whole bunch of people to fellowship with after church. But yet, you think about it, how much more grateful would he be than we are right now? I think he'd be conscious of what he actually has. And a lot of times I think about, you know, just how tough it must be for him. One time he told me he doesn't have anyone's feet to wash on Passover. Just him. I thought, boy, when's the last time any of us had that problem? Not very rarely does that happen, I imagine. Let's turn to Hebrews 10. Hebrews 10. Hebrews 10, verse 24. And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. When we think about it here, how appreciative are the fact that we have a place to come. I mean, we really think about that. In Paul's time, we see people were forsaking the gathering of brethren. You know, and we think about, you know, do we have that going on now? Do we have people that don't really appreciate the fact that I have a place to meet and they're forsaking the gathering now? Because you think about it. If you could, throughout the week, have your co-workers be members of God's church, would you want them to be? I think you would. If you had your boss, would you want your bosses to be your co-worker, or your bosses to be members of God's church? Would you want them to be? Absolutely, you would. Now, what about your subordinates? Yes, because and the reason for that is everyone being like-minded. Everyone would see God's law and would practice it. And we'd have a common way of dealing with problems at that point. But too often we don't. So we have to come out of the world at least one day out of the week and be with people of like mind and appreciate the fact of what we really do have. thinking, you know, how much do we have to deal with people who don't think like us? The things they do, the things they say, the way they handle problems. And we have, you know, this opportunity every week to come out of that world and to be with each other. I think it's a great opportunity. What about outside of church? In Kalamazoo, we get done around 12 o'clock, 12:30. Are we inviting people over to our homes for that next 5 to 6 hours afterwards to really appreciate having them having them in our lives? It's an opportunity to really come together, appreciate the fact that, you know, we have this time, talk about something that we have in common, that's God and our way of life. But I think so often that we miss those opportunities. We miss the opportunities to be with each other after services. And so often we just come to church, we sing our songs, we hear a message, we fellowship a little bit. That's about 3 hours of our day. We have 21 other hours of our Sabbath, and we're not spending that with each other. I think we should be appreciative of our brothers and sisters in our congregations more. That's just my take on it. So I think about, you know, just how many people out there don't have the opportunity we have to have 30, 40, sometimes 50 people meeting with us at a week. Maybe sometimes they're just by themselves. It reminds me of a time when I was a kid at the Feast of Tabernacles, and the wall, I think, just came down. Berlin Wall came down, and I think the Eastern Europe was now open. And we discovered there's people over in Eastern Europe, communist Eastern Europe, keeping God's holy days and law and everything that we do. And they were permitted to hear Herbert Armstrong's voice, but somehow they were still doing it. And some of you may remember it better than me at the time. They were really probably appreciative of the fact that, you know, wow, there's other people out there like us, because they're probably hiding in their homes, keeping it. Probably weren't allowed to have a Bible in some cases. And then now they're over, at the time, they came over to Florida and were meeting with us. We were getting pictures with them. It was kind of funny at the time. We got pictures with them. And because we just thought it was so cool. These people out here never heard the heard Herbert Armstrong's voice, yet they were keeping God's ways. Think how much more appreciative they were of being able to come together with like people of like minds. So that's kind of the minds we probably should have a little bit more. Let's take a look at our congregations directly now, a little bit closer, take a little bit more of a micro look at it. Are we thankful for the children we have in our congregation? Are we thankful for the children? Turn to Matthew 19. Matthew 19. And we're going to read and start reading verse 13 here. Then little children were brought to him, that he might put his hands on them and pray. But the disciples rebuked them. But Jesus said, "Let the little children come to me, and do not forbid them, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." You can picture the disciples over there, kind of acting as the bouncers for Jesus. Wait, hold up now. No, hold up. This is an important man. You just don't walk up to this guy. You know, keep those little children away from him. This is an important man. Do you know who he is? You just don't walk up to him. And Christ looks over and probably spots what's going on pretty easy. And he stops and says, "Hold it now. You hold it. You bring these folks here. You bring those kids here." And the parents wanted Christ to have his hands on them, just to bless them, to give them opportunity and hope they maybe never had. Fill them up with the Holy Spirit. And so Christ says, you think, you know, for the kingdom of heaven is such. Well, think about if you've seen a little kid learning to write and speak and do things. I mean, they just can't get enough of learning. I mean, they're on fire for learning a lot of times, you know, writing stuff, learning words, sounding them out. And that's the kind of mindset we need to have, isn't it? One of passion for learning, desire, optimism. You know, most of the time kids, you know, doesn't matter how bad you treat them, they're going to love you anyways. You know? Just, you know, I'm talking little kids. You know, older kids is a little different a lot of times. But little kids, I'm talking. They'll come in, you know, "Hey, you know, happy to see you." Doesn't matter if you yelled at them, you know, 2 hours before that. That's the attitude more we need to have, and I think that's what Christ was pointing out. Now, what about our seniors in our congregation? What about our seniors? Do we appreciate the perspective they have, the knowledge and wisdom they have, the experience they have? what about some of the older seniors that were around in 1950s and 60s when the church was kind of just picking up speed and really taking off? Think of the perspective they have on the church, seeing it grow to 140,000 members worldwide, the radio program, television program being broadcast all over the world, and then to see the church split in 95 and some splits after that. What perspective they must have on the whole thing. It's kind of interesting to talk with, you know, the people who are longtime members about that. Turn to Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19:32. You shall rise, and rise also means to honor. You shall honor before the gray-headed, and honor the presence of an old man, and fear your God. I am the Lord. When he says, I am the Lord, he really means it too. Honor the gray-headed, so that we know what that means. Are we? Do we do enough of that? Do we really appreciate the fact that we have older folks in our congregation that we can learn from them? So we have our children, older folks. Are we grateful for that? We're grateful for having it. Are we grateful for the opportunity that we have to bring up little children in our congregations? That's the future we have of the church right there. Do we appreciate the responsibility we have to making sure they know God's truth and that they're walking down a straight line and that we're not letting them get off on other areas that are not good for them? It's a lot of responsibility for us, but I think we should be glad and grateful for that opportunity we have. A lot of people can come in and visit West Michigan and they say, wow, that's a lot of, you know, got quite a bit of kids here. We don't have any. Well, you know, it's kind of nice having that, isn't it? Actually have a, you know, a Sabbath school from time to time and that nature. Let's think about also, are we thankful for our calling? Are we thankful for the calling that we have? The fact that we've been called out of the world. We're not blindly walking around like so many others do. We actually know God's truth. We're able to keep God's truth. So how do we show appreciation for having that calling? Do we just go, you know, attend church every week, you know? As the term goes, pray and pay. That's all we do, pray and pay. Or are we actively part of our churches? Are we actively keeping God's commandments? Showing God that we really appreciate having a place to come is by showing up to church. Not staying home or having better things to do. Actually, being at church shows that we appreciate having the opportunity and we're grateful for it. Keeping God's commandments shows that we're appreciative and grateful for having known them. When we don't keep them, are we really showing we're appreciative? If we never come to church, are we really grateful for having this opportunity? Is that, you know, I don't know. I don't think that is an attitude of being grateful. If we never keep God's commandments properly, we don't ever strive to keep them properly. I think there's things that, you know, we need to, as a church, maybe examine ourselves more about that. Turn to Deuteronomy 8. Deuteronomy 8. You know, Israel, at this time, was getting kind of Moses' final farewell address here in Deuteronomy, trying to give him a pep talk, you know, motivational speech, in other words, reminding them of where they came from, telling them what they need to do to be successful in the cross over the Jordan into the Promised Land. Remember, Moses wasn't going to be able to go with them. This was Moses' last opportunity to make sure Israel was on the right footing going into the Promised Land. His last stitch effort, you could say. He says here in Deuteronomy 8, every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe that you may live and multiply. A promise there, in other words. You keep the commandments and you may live and multiply. And go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you, allowed you to hunger and to feed, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man should not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. So God's humbled Israel, allowed them to be hungry at times, so when they had food, they appreciated it. Your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell in these 40 years. And that's kind of interesting there, you really read that. The clothes never wore out on them. The clothes they walked out in the wilderness with the ones probably they had most of the time there. So God allowed the garments not to wear out because they probably didn't have the ability to really make new garments. It's kind of interesting. I never really realized that, but they probably weren't out there making new sheepskin clothing, you know, the latest and greatest fashion trends and all that. They were using the same stuff from 40 years, so, you know, they must have felt really out of date by the time they went into the promised land. But I'm sure they got the latest and greatest in sheep clothing and other things by then. Verse 5, you should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into the good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of the valley and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing. A land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten and are full, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. And bless means to give thanks, praise him. Let him know how much you really appreciate what you have. What he's telling him is that you're going to have full bellies. You're going to eat the best food. You're going to have the best tasting foods, the highest quality you can get. You're going to have fashionable clothing for once. You're going to be able to dig copper out of the hills and make all the greatest things you ever wanted. You have the best homes, the latest of everything. And what you need to do is remember, I gave it to you and led you to this point. So he's reminding them, give thanks to me. Don't forget me. Be grateful for this, what I'm giving you. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and statutes, which I command you today. At least when you have eaten and are full and have built beautiful homes and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. It's a key word there in 14, when. It doesn't say if. It's not conditional. It doesn't say if you do this. It says when. It's going to happen. You're going to forget me, and you're going to forget what happened. You're going to forget that I led you out of the wilderness for 40 years. I put you into this promised land, and you're going to forget me. And when this happens, what do you think God's going to do? He talked about how he humbled him. He's going to humble you. He's going to bring you back down to where you can appreciate that. What he's saying here is that it says when. When your heart is lifted up. When your heart's lifted up means you feel really good, don't you? You're feeling awesome. Like Superman. I got big homes. I got all the food I can eat. No one can touch me. I got money in the bank. And then when you forget me, this is what he's getting into here, saying that, you know, this is what I've led you through. Who fed you? 15. Who led you through the great and terrible wilderness in which were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you, that he might test you, that to do you good in the end. So humbling them, making them grateful for what they have now. He's humbling them, bringing them back down at that point. So when they knew, when their bellies were full and they had nice things, they'd appreciate it, actually. It's reminding them here. 17. Then you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. Oh, isn't that a bad attitude? Isn't that a bad attitude? I mean, how often do we all get like that from time to time? I did this. Boy, I, you know, that raise I got at work, boy, I did it. That contract I won, I got it. No one else got it. How quickly do we have an attitude of me, 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 I did it. When the truth is, without God, without having there giving you the ability, the capabilities, giving you the intelligence, opening doors for you that you probably didn't see were opened, you wouldn't be there. You wouldn't have the opportunity. But he's talking to Israel, saying, this is going to be your attitude. You're going to forget eventually that I gave you these things, and you're going to be me, me, me. Don't do that, though. He's warning them not to do it, but he says it's going to happen, probably. Well, you need to remember this. 18, and you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is today, this day. Then it shall be, if you by any means forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day that you shall surely perish. As the nations with the Lord, which the Lord destroys before you, so shall perish because you would not be obedient to the voice of the Lord your God. So he's warning them. If you start getting a me attitude that I'm great, I did this, look at all that I have the best, I'm successful, I did all this. When God got you to that point, you're dependent on him through the wilderness, you're dependent on everything, and then you get to this point now, and you forget me, you ingrates. And this is what's going to happen, you're going to perish. And sure enough, they did perish. Carried out by the Assyrians, Babylonians, weren't they? Well, as we see, generation to generation gets a little more forgetful about the blessings we have. Let's look at our country here, the United States. Could you imagine the attitudes that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin had compared to ours today? They'd probably say, what in the world is going on? They probably wouldn't believe the state of our country's in right now. That's where we're at. Too often we have to be brought down, don't we? And we have to be hungry to appreciate food, thirsty to appreciate water. We have to have a lack of income to appreciate the jobs we had or the job we did have. And so the key is here, can we figure out how we can get out of that mode of me, or whatever it is? And remember, even when things are good, our health is good, don't take it for granted. Keep working towards better. Keep working so that God doesn't, you know, that you don't forget God. Because the attitude of me is one that some scientists had one time. So a group of scientists were standing around. I said, boy, aren't we smart? Look at all we did. We can clone sheep. We can fly to the moon. We've created the internet, and we can, you know, send messages to China and back within seconds. We can jump on planes and submarines. We have nuclear energy. Aren't we smart? You know that God guy? He's really in our way now, isn't he? We need to go tell him this. Let's go tell him this. We don't need him anymore. We don't need his ways. We don't need his laws. You know, we can bless ourselves now and carry for ourselves. So the group got together and drew straws on who's going to go tell God this message. And they drew, and Joe got it. This guy named Joe, the scientist, got it. So he goes in, and he meets up with God and tells him, you know, God, you know, we've been talking to guys back at, you know, local 101 science shop. We don't need you anymore. We've got everything. And he goes through the spiel of what they have, and God's sitting there, you know, stroking his chin knowingly, you know, shaking his head, listening very politely. And finally, the guy gets done with the spiel and says, you understand? You know, God, oh, yeah, I understand what you're saying. Let's do this. Let's have a man-creating contest. And the guy says, okay, all right. And he says, God says, well, we're going to do it the way I did it originally, with dirt, breathing life in the dirt. And the guy says, all right, okay. He reached down, grabbed some dirt, and the guy says, what? And God says, whoa, put that dirt down. That's my dirt. So, you know, that's the thing that we forget too often, just like these scientists did, that without the dirt that God created, we wouldn't be able to create the man, right? And so often, you know, we think we did it all, but without having the opportunities, without having the capabilities, without having the intelligence that, you know, a lot of people don't have. If you haven't been paying attention, there's a lot of people that don't have intelligence. And without having these things, we wouldn't be able to accomplish what we have been able to. So that's a quite interesting story, but I think that kind of sums up that kind of piece of it, that point I'm trying to make there. In Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, he went around and talked to different influential people. Andrew Carnegie wrote him letters and opened doors for him. And eventually, Dale Carnegie kind of got his own fame, was able to open doors on his own. But he went and talked to Charles Schwab. Now, Charles Schwab is not the same guy you see in commercials. It's a different Charles Schwab. But in 1921, at the age of 38, Charles Schwab was tapped to be the leader of the newly formed U.S. Steel Company. In 1921, he drew a salary of $1 million a year. Now, this was before they were taxing you, your income. So he had a lot of that to keep for himself, in other words. This was back when $50 a week was probably a lot of money. So $1 million a year is a lot of money now, and some lot of money then. So I don't know what the scale is, but it's probably tens of millions of dollars now in comparison. But he asked a question to Schwab, and this was Carnegie asked him. He said, "You know, what makes you so valuable to draw that kind of a salary?" You know, not everybody just draws that kind of money or commands that kind of money. He says, you know, Schwab says this, is that I'm not a genius. Never have been. I'm not the smartest guy. There's plenty of people in the factory that know more about steel making than I do. But he goes on to say here, I consider my ability to arouse enthusiasm among my people, says Schwab, the greatest asset I possess. And the way to develop the best that is in a person is by appreciation and encouragement. There's nothing else that so kills the ambition of a person as criticism from superiors. I never criticize anyone. I believe in giving a person incentive to work. So I'm anxious to praise, but loath to find fault. If I like anything, I'm hearty in my approbation and lavish in my praise. He's very appreciative. He probably gave people handwritten thank you notes. Probably went on the floor and shook people's hands and said thank you for the work you're doing and meant it. It wasn't flattery. Flattery comes from the teeth, is what Dale Carnegie said. Flattery, everybody can spot it in a minute. You know when you're being flattered. You're being told what you want to hear, not what you probably need to hear. And someone's saying, you know, something that's just not true. It's like counterfeit money. Eventually it's going to be found, is what Carnegie said. But appreciation, gratitude, really giving someone true praise comes from the heart. And people know it. I think you know it. You know, when you really get some appreciation from somebody, you feel it and you know it. That's a different. That's a, you know, you really can appreciate it and feel it and know it when that happens. I got this article as I was preparing for the sermon. I did some research and I come across this article. It's quite interesting. It kind of tells you a little bit about the state of our country right now. It's comes from folks here called Brett and Kay McKay. This was published on June 4th, 2009. It's off their website. And if you're interested, I can get you the website later. But it's called The Art of Manliness, the website is. They are trying to reestablish, this couple here, trying to reestablish men being men. And they mean gentlemen, is basically what they're saying. Is that, you know, too often we see in these reality shows men being idiots and knuckle-draggers and stuff that are portrayed on television. It's one thing that always drives me nuts is when you watch television, you see these fathers on TV, and they're walking around as knuckle-draggers, idiots. Everyone's smarter than them, including their kids. And it takes you back, and you see all the shows that my parents had me watching, and Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best and stuff like that. You think, well, those guys were, you know, actually went to them for counsel and wisdom, and they were actually really intelligent men, and they actually displayed what a man is supposed to be like. Well, too often we don't see it anymore, and so these folks are noticing that, and they want to start reestablishing what a man actually is supposed to be like and not what you see on television. So they have a 30-day challenge. It says 30 days to a better man. Day 5, cultivating your gratitude. Now, this is true for everybody. This isn't just for men. This is true of anybody who really wants to show appreciation. And they start out with this newspaper clipping. The District of Columbia police auctioned off about 100 unclaimed bicycles Friday. $1, said the 11-year-old boy, as the bidding opened on the first bike. The bidding, however, went much higher than $1. $1, the boy repeated, hopefully each time another bike came up. The auctioneer, who had been auctioning stolen or lost bikes, for 43 years, noticed that the boy's hopes seemed to soar higher when a racer-type bicycle was put up. I can relate to that. I wanted a racer, too. Then there was just one racer left. The bidding went to $8. Sold to the boy over there for $9. Remember, he only had $1. So, sold, the auctioneer said. Then he took $8 from his own pocket and asked the boy for his dollar. The youngster turned it over in pennies, nickels, and dimes and quarters, took his bike, and started to leave. But he went only a few feet, carefully parking his new possession. He went back, gratefully threw his arms around the auctioneer's neck, and cried. He was so happy and thankful. So happy and thankful. When was the last time, it goes on to say here, you felt gratitude as profoundly as that little boy did? Now, isn't that something? I mean, that's the model right there. If you appreciate something, first of all, I've read many times that if you want to say thank you when something happens. Don't wait 2 weeks or a month a lot of times to say thank you. Do it when the actual event took place. That boy turned around and gave that guy a hug. How do you think he felt about it? You know, he probably felt awesome too. That's the model they're talking about here. It goes on to say here, Aesop said, "Gratitude is a sign of noble souls. Indeed, gratitude is one of the hallmarks of a life well lived. It is a virtue that profoundly impacts your personal happiness and the quality of your relationships. A lack of gratitude is often at the root of a variety of ills that plague relationships. When a wife or husband never shows appreciation for their spouse, the embers of their love are soon extinguished. When a boss never thanks his employees for what they do, the employees start to resent both him and their job." Now, that's true. I've seen that with a lot of employees. You know, they have great jobs and they don't think management appreciates them, and they begin to hate them. "Well, they don't care about us. You see what they just did?" You know, and that kind of attitude starts creeping in. And it spreads like wildfire. On the flip side, nothing can buoy up our relationships quite like gratitude. A warm word of appreciation can instantly thaw the ice between people. That's true. A lot of times you just say, you know, you thank them for something they've done or whatever, and all of a sudden, and you really mean it too. It really does open up and change people's demeanor a lot of times. How often do we thank our wives for taking care of those little errands we forgot to do? They're talking to me here, aren't they? How often do we thank our girlfriends for how thoughtful they are? When was the last time we thanked our coworkers for helping us get a project ready or our friend for being there to help us move? That's very true. We often assume that people either get thanks from other people or they just somehow know how grateful we are. Intuitively, right? You know, they just know when we are thankful. We are for what they do. We are usually wrong on both accounts. Here's another old story that illustrates this well. A group of friends, in the midst of an after-dinner conversation, start talking about what they had to be thankful for. One of the group said, "Well, I, for one, am grateful to Mrs. Wendt, an old school teacher who 30 years ago in the little West Virginia town went out of her way to introduce me to the works of the poet Tennyson. And does this Mrs. Wendt know that she made that contribution to your life?" Someone put in. "I'm afraid she doesn't. I have been careless and have never in all these years told her face to face or by letter." The person says, "Then why don't you write her?" And challenges them there. The writer here says, "Now all of this is very poignant to me because Mrs. Wendt was my teacher." So the guy writing it says, "This is really hit home because it's my teacher. And I was a fellow who hadn't written. That very evening, I tried to atone on that chance. That Mrs. Wendt might still be living, I sat down and wrote her what I call a Thanksgiving letter. This is the handwritten note that I had in return," so she wrote him back. It began, My dear Willie, I am now an old lady in my 80s, living alone in a small room, cooking my own meals, lonely and seemingly like the last leaf of fall left behind. You'll be interested to know, Willie, that I taught school for 50 years, and all that time, yours is the first note of appreciation I ever received. It came on a blue, cold morning, and it cheered my lonely, old heart as nothing has cheered me in many years." So he says thank him, and she turns around and says thank you back, didn't she? What a great, you know, setup that is. I mean, just an example of how that is. He didn't know how much she touched. She didn't know how much she touched his life, and he didn't know how much that note meant. But when they told each other, now they both know. What prevents us from showing our gratitude more freely? Gratitude is inexplicably tied with the virtue of humility. This is when I started really perking up in this article, because what I've been reading in the Bible is about God, how much he has to humble people, make them feel gratitude. So I started thinking, well, that's an interesting tie-in to what I'm talking about. Gratitude shows that we're paying attention to the acts of service people perform for us, that we truly understand how those acts make our life better, easier, and happier. The ungrateful man is callous. He came to think that all the good things that happened to him and all the service rendered for him are an automatic response to his impeachable awesomeness. And I think this writer must have been reading Deuteronomy 8, right? Basically what God was saying is that you think you did all this, you're just awesome, aren't you? Boy, you're just the best. He deserves all that stuff and more. Thus, he never takes notice of the good things that happen to him, and he never really is happy with what he has. He deserves only the best in life and concentrates solely on the ways in which this ideal hasn't been met. The grateful man is a humble man. He has no illusions of his grandeur. He knows that that bad things happen to good people. He knows how easily a rally can turn into a slump, especially if you have a 401k, you really know this. He knows how much worse off many others are than he is. He understands the sacrifice others make on his behalf, and he deeply, deeply appreciates them. That's this article just backs up what we were reading there in Deuteronomy 8, isn't it? Too often we get an attitude of, man, I'm great. But what he's saying is a grateful person is humble. They don't need to be humbled. They've already know, they probably have been humbled in their life. They don't need to be humbled again to experience it. So it goes on here to say, gratitude is not simply something that we externally share with others. It is an attitude that we live by every day. An attitude. Like I said, it's an attitude. It's not just, it's a way of life. It's the way you think. It's the way you want to be. If something happens, you automatically think, I need to show some appreciation for it. You don't have, it's not delayed gratification, in other words, you know, in terms of thanking other people. Some of the unhappiest men I've ever met in life have also been the most ungrateful. Well, that's true, probably, isn't it? They could only see the things that were wrong with their life, choosing to concentrate on the things they wished they had and wished they hadn't happened but didn't. Their whining corrupted their soul. On the flip side, some of the happiest men I've known are the ones that truly embraced the virtue of gratitude. Some of them were dirt poor, but they were still so grateful for what little they did have. They focused on the things they lacked. They did not focus on the things they lacked, but on all the things they had going for them. And like I said, it's what King David, I think it's what King David's attitude was. Always looking what he had, what he was blessed with, what God gave him. He was happy about that. He didn't sit there and say, oh, woe is me, I'm being pursued by King Saul. At times he felt slow about it, but he also gave plenty of thanks too. Some people think if they had more stuff or better luck, then they would magically have more gratitude. But the number of more material possessions or relationships will have no effect on your attitude. Isn't that true? We see a lot of people who have things, and they just they complain, you know, I'd be more happy if I had a better home or a bigger home. Or if I had this. Or if my husband was more like that, I'd be happy. And when things do happen, and the husband changes, or they get a bigger house, or they get more of this, magically you're not happy. Maybe for a month or two, is this kind of the honeymoon of change sometimes kind of holds you over for a month or two. Eventually that wears off and you want more. Oh, if I only had that. Once you got those things, you would simply start thinking about new things you wanted. Amen. Gratitude is an attitude that can be cultivated in whatsoever circumstances you find yourself in. It is not about good things happening to you. It's about finding new layers of wonderfulness in things that you have right now. And then it goes on here a little bit more. It starts giving you some action items, which you might want to take notes on. I thought it was pretty good. Today's task has two parts to help you work on both your personal gratitude and also showing your gratitude to others. Part one, cultivate your personal gratitude. It's time to take stock of all the good things in life that we have to be thankful for. So task one is to make a list of 10 things you're grateful for. 10 things. Not that many. When you start, big things will probably come to mind first. Health, family, job, kids, etc. But remember, gratitude really works. It's magic in your life when you start taking notice of the great layers of pleasure present in everyday things. Often we walk around like zombies, totally numb to the great beauty and joy experienced each day. So think about really specific things, not just I'm thankful for my wife, but I'm thankful that my wife makes me laugh every day. Or that my wife laughs at me every day. In some people's case. Not just I'm thankful for my kids, but I'm thankful for how happy it makes me when my kids rush to the door when I come home from work. And that's true. That is very nice as a parent to have that. And you talk to parents who have teenage kids and their kids aren't young anymore, and they say they miss that a lot of times. It's one of the things they miss. That is really nice, that unconditional love that kids have. It doesn't have to be deep stuff. You can be thankful for a delicious meal of beer and pizza, or how fresh the house smells when the windows are open. Really take some time to think about the stuff that gives you pleasure and happiness. And don't feel like being grateful for material things is superficial. It's okay to be grateful that you have a new couch or new TV or a new car. It's okay. Those are legitimate things. That's not being superficial, he's saying here, and I agree with that. It's great to take time and reflect on how thankful you are for your 350Z, and I imagine that's a car he's talking about. Too many times we skimp. Okay, so the other part of it is part two here. Part two. So part one is make a list of 10 things that you really appreciate. And be specific. You know, go into some detail about what you do like about it. Part two, show your gratitude to others. Too many times we skimp on thank yous because something has happened so often it becomes routine, or we figure the person already knows how thankful we are for them. As I said above, they often don't, and if you do, telling them directly will harm their soul. Telling them directly will harm their soul and make their day, will warm their soul, excuse me. Probably wondering, what's he talking about? Warms their soul, not harms their soul. Warms their soul and makes their day. So, task two is to give three thank yous to three different people. So that's the action item. Three thank yous to three different people today. These have to be specific thank yous. I'm not talking about your waiter bringing your soup to you saying, oh, thank you for the soup, or thank you for holding the door for me, they're saying. In return, although you could at the end of the meal say, I just wanted to tell you how grateful I am for the extraordinary service you gave tonight. It's okay to thank people for just doing their job well. Yeah, they're just doing their job. But I think we all know plenty of people who can't even rise to that level. That is true, isn't it? I mean, if you get bad service at a restaurant, even if someone just gives good service and you expect it, you're like, well, thank you. You know, you think in your own mind, well, should I have to? Well, yes, you should probably give them a thank you. Or if you get a really good meal from, you know, tell the chef, it was really great, I really appreciate the food. Probably doesn't hear it very often. Probably hears more complaints than they do thank yous. So, you know, be more specific about how you give the thank yous. Thank you. Thank your significant other for how wonderful she is, and to mention some specific things about her that you love. Thank your coworker for bringing donuts. Thank. Yeah, that's some people really like that. Thank your AOM community member for the contributions to the community. Thank your teacher for how great he or she is. It doesn't have to be present stuff either. Give another thank you to your friend who showed you the best time in New York City when you came to visit 2 years ago. So they're saying you can go back in time and give a thank you. Send a thank you to the old professor you had in college who really opened your mind. Call your brother and thank him for helping you get through a tough, rough time that you had last fall. Think about people you should have thanked but missed your chance with, or the people you really didn't thank enough. These thank yous can be done in person, on a post-it note, by letter, by email, by phone, whatever. Just put some thought into it and get going. At Consumers Energy, I did sit on the employee engagement team at a department I was in, and one of the guys who would help out in storm calls. So when a storm blows through, knocks down a bunch of limbs, it's kind of all hands on deck to get the power back on. Well, this particular guy was an instructor and worked in the training department, but he went over and helped out a guy in another area, another field leader in another area, with trying to get power restored in that region. I think a couple days later, a week later, he got a handwritten thank you note in the mail from the guy saying, thank you for your service and your help in this time. I tell you what, that guy talked about that over and over again. He wrote a whole article on it for these newsletters we pushed out to people about employee engagement. It made his day getting that note. This is an old grizzly tough line worker here, and getting that thank you note warmed his heart. So don't underestimate or think that someone's not going to appreciate it, because a lot of people do appreciate it. And they would really enjoy getting something from you. So remember the words of Charles Schwab. Be hearty in your approbation and lavish in your praise. Praise to God, praise to each other, praise for your blessings. Many blessings we do have, and we do have many of them. Making that list, I think of 10 would be great. But remember, to keep an attitude of gratitude.